This is the art of discussing, where everyone is committed to having discussions with people sharing different points of view while respecting the person expressing them. We're your hosts. I'm Ben.
And I'm Kate. And we're excited that you've joined us. Let's get to this week's episode. Welcome to this episode of Art of Discussing. I'm one of your hosts. I'm Kate.
And I'm Ben.
And today we're talking about the voting system, so U.S. domestic policy, specifically around voting system. And we're going to get into the Electoral College versus the popular vote. It's going to be a great episode. We have Dr. Douglas Bradabo here, and I'm going to pass it over to Ben. Can you introduce our guests for us?
Sure. Joining us today is Dr. Doug Bradabo. In my experience, he was my college professor in undergrad, which is actually this year, 20 years ago. So class of 2002 is a little bit ago. And I took my undergrad degree was in political science. And Dr. Bradabo, I took his American presidency class, and actually as soon as Kate and I started thinking about how we were going to explore this season on statecraft, and actually hadn't even really gotten to specifically the president's role or the executive or talking about the Constitution or the voting system. And just in the realm of statecraft, I thought immediately to myself, we've got to have Dr. Bradabo on as a guest, because your breadth of knowledge on this subject, your ability to impart it to others is, to me personally, priceless. And your wit also just makes it easier to go down. So some people don't love history. I love history. I love that you love history. And I love that how you bring history and what is happening back then to life for others to easily kind of get. So for our listeners, Dr. Bradabo, Doug, if you just tell us a little bit about yourself, and I read that voting behavior is actually something that you're really researching, and I'm very excited. That's all.
Thanks a bunch, Ben. It is a delight to be able to see you again. You look every bit the person I remember, even though it's been a couple decades. Time does not stop, does it?
Not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all.
It just keeps moving, but a real pleasure to be with you today. And I guess in a nutshell, I'd introduce myself by saying that I grew up in Iowa, and because during my childhood, as is the case today, Iowa went first and still goes first in the presidential nominating process, I always had a chance, even when I was 8, 9, 10 years old, to meet all the presidential candidates of both main political parties. And so I kind of feel like that gave me an extra reason to be very interested in politics as a young person. And after graduating from high school, I went to the University of Iowa as an undergraduate, majored in political science and history, studied the American presidency at the University of Maryland at College Park, got a doctorate in the study of that. Went to Georgetown Law School, night school, graduated from that, joined the Maryland bar, and then got a job at USNA teaching while you were there. And that is how our paths crossed. These days, I am in Ohio here at Hiram College, and I run the James A. Garfield Center for the Study of the American Presidency. And we have a 4-year cycle, a group of undergraduates, about 20 of them a year, spend a year studying in chronological order President Thomas Jefferson, President Abraham Lincoln, President Theodore Roosevelt, and President Lyndon Johnson and civil rights. This year is our year of LBJ, Martin Luther King, and civil rights. So that gives you an idea of kind of what I'm up to, or what I've been up to, I guess.
Wow. Well, that's an interesting journey. I guess to start, you know, delving into voting and how it relates to our chief executive and the Constitution, let's just start with where most people are at. And that is, most people know that we have an electoral college, and they know that it's the subject of let's just call it a dash of controversy here and there, versus what they more probably intuitively understand, the populist vote. How did we, can you explain to us briefly how we got to the Electoral College and like the compromise that kind of have us have the popular vote and the Electoral College, and a little bit about that for our listeners?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to do that as concisely as I can do it here. So the framers in creating the Electoral College created something brand new. When they showed up at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, they had three main alternative plans for selecting the President of the United States. The first one was to have a popular vote, but some of the framers were skeptical of the masses and of having the masses make a decision that important to choose the executive. They also had legitimate doubts about how would you carry off an election day from the islands off the coast of Maine to the islands off the coast of Florida, from the Eastern Seaboard all the way up into the Appalachians. And so for a combination of both of those reasons, they decided they did not want to do a popular election. The next possibility was that they said, well, you know, maybe Congress could pick the president. Maybe we could have an executive chosen by the legislative branch in some kind of vote. They also rejected that idea, and they rejected it because to their eyes, it violated the separation of powers. And if you had one branch picking the executive and the other branch, this would, of course, make the executive beholden to, maybe capable of being manipulated by the Congress. So they threw out their second option. Their third option, some of them thought, was to have the states pick the national executive. But they also were skeptical of that approach because they believed that this new constitution, showcasing as it did the supremacy clause, right, could not have a national executive be beholden to the states. After all, the Articles of Confederation, our first attempt at a governing document, right, had collapsed, right, completely imploded because we did not have a meaningful, powerful national government or a national executive of any kind. So with those three alternatives thrown out, they had to kind of start from scratch. And one thing you can say about the Electoral College is that it combined aspects of all of those other three plans. It's this weird, intricate mousetrap of a thing. And what it had going for it was that it could be sold in the states when people went home from the Constitutional Convention in the fall of 1787. They could make a pitch to the delegates back in their home states that really we need to sign up for this constitution. And yeah, the Electoral College doesn't have everything we wanted in the way we would pick a national executive, but look, it's got something in it that you liked or that you supported. So one other thing I just want to mention is that the effect of having an Electoral College combined with the three-fifths clause in the way that we counted enslaved African Americans gave a huge boost in representational power to the rural South. And it's still today, the Electoral College gives a big boost to very sparsely populated states. You can, for instance, be Montana with not too much more than 500,000 people, and you're still going to have three electoral votes no matter what. That's the minimum number because you get the number of electoral votes that your state has, two senators plus its number of representatives. The minimum number of representatives is one. So the effect of the Electoral College, for example, early on in 1800 was to give Thomas Jefferson the math necessary to win the presidency. There were those who said when Jefferson became the third president of the United States that he had ridden to power on the backs of slaves, meaning that without the Electoral College, it would not have been possible for his support to translate into a meaningful Electoral College victory in the way that it did. And of course, today, we know and we have experienced situations recently in 2000 and again in 2016, right, where a president was elected by winning the Electoral College, getting 270 more electoral votes, but loses in the popular vote nationwide. So that's a quick primer there on how we got what we have.
That's helpful as a refresh for somebody who is not a history nerd like others and who hasn't really done a lot of this since high school. So thank you for that. I think that was really interesting. And that goes to the system portion of kind of what we're talking about. When we were creating this season, Ben and I kind of, Ben's idea was, well, it's systems versus trends, right? Like the system is codified to your point, the Electoral College, but then the trends either try to influence it, try to change it, based on what's happening in current events. So it definitely sounds like the trend, which is probably more the system, became the system of slavery. Now the system has all these things based on what was acceptable at that time. And it's interesting, I guess I hadn't really thought of it in that perspective of the reasons why they did that and the rural areas having more than potentially other places. So you kind of speak to that. Hopefully that communicated, Ben, if you have anything you want to add, but like that speaks to how the system and trends kind of, I don't want to say battle each other, but how they influence each other or one influences the other.
And I'll say a little bit more about that, Doug. We had a conversation in discussing statecraft and what would entail and what would it look like, right? And our first couple of seasons, our first season was about unconscious bias. So that was something that was, you know, relatively fresh in our mind. Our second season explored the pandemic and its kind of impact on the nation and other stuff that is coming up.
Personal freedom versus collective.
Right, personal freedom versus collective safety, those sorts of undertones. So in talking about statecraft and role of government and really big picture kind of stuff, it became clear to me that there are certain things that people hold up as, you know, being part of, because we also hear a lot of, you know, this system's broken, that system broken, the system's broken. Everybody, you hear these things all the time.
It's all broken.
A little bit to like dig into it, right? And hear, okay, what system is broken? What are we talking about? But looking at systems. And then I thought you have like a civil rights movement coming forward a couple of decades. Now you have a Me Too movement, right? You have the Black Lives Matter movement. You have all sorts of, you have a Tea Party movement. You have all sorts of movements. And it was in that moment that I kind of thought, okay, these are trends, right? Strong trends, weaker trends that are trying to influence the system. And as a definition for this season, what we came up with is a system is what is written down, what something that you can point to, the Constitution, that is part of the system of our government, right? Like you could point to it, it's written down, it's in the Constitution, which within bounds, right? I hear people throw a lot of stuff around that's in the Constitution. I'm sure increasingly a lot of us have heard these things, and it's just not. It's if you read the text of the system, you're familiar with the system, you can get those things. And to expand it to, for instance, Kate and I looked up, we didn't look over because it's heady, but like the rules for the United States Senate, the rules for, you know, conduct of the U.S. Congress, you know, those things, it's part of the system. They do what they do because it's written in there. Now, by way of juxtaposition, a filibuster is not. Right? It's not written in there. And it's a trend that kind of works because it's not expressly forbidden by the system. And people have said, hey, this, I can use this, get my way. That's a trend. And the goal of most trends, it seems, the civil rights movement, Black Lives Matter, Me Too, you know, pretty much any system that's trying to affect change, the way to affect real change is to have your trend be incorporated into the system. And until that point, even if you have a strong trend and that's the way people are, you know, the prevailing viewpoint for the populace, ultimately, if it's not included in the system, it leaves leeway for the trend to reverse itself.
More subtly, though, Ben, if you look at it like you have a law on the books, right? How do you enforce that law may depend on a trend, or how somebody sees that law, whether it's law enforcement or the populace, may also be based on the trends
right.
of the day. So the law may not change, and it may. They may actually change it, but that's in, like, a more subtle version of it.
Right. So we just give that all to you.
That was a lot.
That's kind of what we were thinking, and a lot of what you just said in your, telling us a little bit about the Electoral College versus the popular vote. I mean, there's so much in there, right? You have the 3/5 compromise that you pointed to, which was a compromise based on a trend, right? That then we got in, we have what we have, our system of government, our checks and balances in order in the system. We created the system around that trend, you know, in order to have everybody be on the same page and go, hey, I can sign off on that. I can agree to that. If you give me my two senators, no matter the size of my state, I don't mind that your population is so huge. And we made an attempt to lower it by making not everybody count as one everybody, one whole everybody. So that's really crazy. But the Electoral College, there's so much there. Well, and there's so much there that Kate says, a history nerd, I assume.
I didn't say it was you.
I know. I didn't.
I'm going to stab.
I'm wearing it like it's me.
I'm
going to
let you
right?
two battle this out here.
No, you know, I do have a question, though. Sorry, to move this forward, Ben.
Go ahead.
Can you give us a little bit? So we talked about the origins of the Electoral College versus the popular vote. You've mentioned and alluded to the 2000 and 2016 elections. Historically, can you kind of give us a snapshot of how it's worked or not worked since it was created?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the 1800s, we had three presidential elections where the popular vote result and the Electoral College result were different. Those were 1824, 1876, and then 1888. Now, the gap between 1888 and 2000 is 112 years. And so this notion, right, that every so often we're going to have an election in which the popular vote winner loses the presidency, that had receded from most living memory. It seemed to be something out of the history books. And then it happened in 2000, the presidential nominee of the Democratic Party, Vice President Al Gore, won by about 540,000 votes, popular votes, but lost the presidency. And 16 years later, we had an election in which the Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton, won by about 3 million votes nationwide, but lost in the Electoral College. So we may now be entered into a period of time in which our parties are configured in a way that means we are going to have these kinds of elections on a regular or semi-regular basis. I think it's important to step back and make an observation here, and that is, in most countries that claim to be democracies, there isn't a distinction between a popular vote for the executive and an Electoral College vote. There's just a thing called voting. And the purpose of voting is that if one person gets more votes than any other, that person becomes the executive. So the United States now has wedged itself into this weird place in modern times where we are beholden to this creation, the Electoral College, that served practical or pragmatic purposes of compromise to get a constitution in place in the day. But now it may be incompatible with our modern sensibilities. It may, I would argue, even be incompatible with the functioning of a modern country in the following way. If a majority consistently votes and in popular vote terms, one candidate carries the day, but again and again is denied the capacity to hold office, that is a recipe for real problems over the longer term. So there are, of course, afoot proposed methods to reform the Electoral College. Probably the most promising is the Electoral Vote Interstate Compact. You can look it up online. States have been passing laws that say when enough states have passed the same law to account for 270 more electoral votes, then the law in those states will enter into effect that the electors from that state in a presidential election will go to the winner of the national popular vote, not to the winner of the individual state's popular vote. I believe we're now at about 200 to 210 electoral votes worth of states that have passed that law. It's gaining steam all the time. It would appear that in some number of years that is not too large, in the next 3 or 5 or 7 or 10 years, somewhere in that time span, enough states will have enacted that law that then we would be in a position to have a de facto popular election in this country. Now, will the Supreme Court get out of the way and say that that is okay? We don't know for certain. No doubt there will be a court case about that when the time comes. I guess I'll make one other point here, and that is that you, in, I think, very eloquently introducing kind of the theme of your season, talked about how movements can become incorporated into the very infrastructure of a republic when we change the Constitution or when we enact laws. Well, we now have a Supreme Court that has worked very hard to cut off at the knees the Voting Rights Act of 1965. And it is now the case that we thought that was a settled matter. We thought we had pretty good national procedures to limit the ways that states could change their voting processes. But the Supreme Court in Shelby County versus Holder ruled that states can really have very wide latitude in setting their voting procedures. So now we have well over a dozen states that are working pretty diligently to make it very difficult for people of color to vote. And we thought that was a settled issue after the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Turns out that's not a settled issue at all. So we probably are going to have in this country a new Voting Rights Act at some point in the years coming up. How politically that gets done, especially in a Senate that has a filibuster still, since we mentioned that a little while ago, that is very hard to tell, but there is a crying need for a very robust new Voting Rights Act in this country.
That was a lot. I'm glad I asked that question. I hadn't realized, I'll just speak for myself, I hadn't realized, again, not a history buff over here. I like it, but I'm not like, I don't dive into it. I didn't realize that for that long, there hadn't been like 2000s election was the first time since the 1800s. Like that I had no idea. So that makes it even more interesting in my brain to see that we've had two in the last, let's say, 20 years.
Yeah, it does appear that the parties geographically and demographically have sorted in such a way that there is going to be a pretty persistent risk in the near and intermediate term of a diverging outcome where one candidate wins the popular vote, but the other candidate wins the presidency. That's a real tangible risk that we are going to be running for a while, I think.
Actually, I had two thoughts on that, Doug, is that one, you still have states like Montana, right? Like that just don't have a lot of population there. And it's my thinking that it will still be those states, your Rhode Islands, your Montanas, your Wyomings, that are affected by this population disparity that will likely resist, I guess, the conversation of abolishing the Electoral College. In your opinion, right? Like, is that still a relevant compromise is that still a relevant compromise in terms of the populist vote, right? Like you do have these people that don't live in those states and they're relatively rural areas. Is that still, I mean, I think it's, I don't live in Montana. I don't live in Wyoming, right? And I don't want to discount those people, but you know, state to state. So how do you see that affecting the conversation going forward in any sort of change? Would it still be relative?
I think you've raised a pretty important point here, and I want to say a few things about it. The first is that at the time of, say, the 1790 census, the first under the new constitution, right?
Right.
The biggest disparity in population, if memory serves, I think was the difference between Pennsylvania and Rhode Island. And that ratio was approximately 7.5 or 8 to 1. So 8 times more people lived in Pennsylvania than lived in Rhode Island, or wow, it may have been Delaware, and I don't have the 1790 results, but I think the general point is fairly clear. Now, if you take a look today, there are 40 million Californians. There are 600,000 or 700,000 people in Wyoming. That ratio isn't an 8 to 1. It's a 70 to 1.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
Would the framers have legitimately foreseen a difference in population between two states that had a ratio of 70 to 1? I'm going to suggest that that would have seemed quite unlikely, quite improbable to them. It wouldn't have been something that they would have foreseen. Now, with that in mind, I think we want to ask a fundamental question about representation. Does the Senate represent, or should it represent, people, or does it somehow represent land where almost nobody lives? And by asking the question, I want to suggest that in a democracy, we represent the views of human beings. We represent the views of people. We don't represent the views of simply a land mass, or for that matter, the flocks of livestock who happen to live on the land mass, grazing right, as they might be. Right. So there is a real difficulty here with saying that we give the same representative power to 700,000 people in Montana in the Senate that we give to 40 million Californians in the Senate. On some level, that just doesn't wash. Now, it's a problem for democratic theory, but it's also a real problem because it is difficult to amend the Constitution of the United States. We've right, only done it 27 times. It takes 2/3 of the House. It takes 2/3 of the Senate. And then 3/4 of the state legislatures must approve an amendment. That is difficult enough, right? That is just very difficult. But note that the Constitution singled out equal representation as one thing that could not be amended by the usual procedure. It would take unanimous consent of all the states. No state, the Constitution says, will be denied its equal representation in the Senate unless it is unanimous. Now, that was aimed to reassure the states on this great compromise where we had a right, House that was popularly elected and where representation was based on population on the one hand versus, on the other hand, equality of statehood, 2 senators per state, no matter what the populations might be. But here we are now with the disparities we've described between California and Wyoming, and we really can't hardly expect an amendment process to get rid of the Electoral College to happen anytime soon. So we're left with workarounds. We're left with that electoral vote interstate compact I mentioned. That might be a de facto sort of bootleg way to get around the reality of the Electoral College and have a de facto popular election. But even that is some years away, and then it's going to have to undergo a Supreme Court test. And we cannot confidently say, or at least not definitely say, that the Supreme Court would look favorably upon that sort of bootleg solution around the existence of the Electoral College.
That is actually fascinating. Do you have any questions, Kate?
No, I didn't know that was a movement or a thing. Yeah, I didn't know that they were. So that's really interesting that that was being proposed and worked on.
I think we should take note of the fact that in the early 1970s, the House of Representatives did approve a constitutional amendment to move to a popular vote in this country. The Senate did not pass it, but the House did. And so we have had many proposals in the history of this country to try to do something about the Electoral College, but because it is so difficult to run the amendment process, none of those things has gotten through both houses and out there to the state legislatures. And of course, you can imagine there will be some portion of states that simply will not give up their disproportionate power in the Electoral College.
Yeah. Right. It's just not in their best interest.
That's right. But I think we have to observe that it is always a shame that what any small number of states considers to be in their best interests may in fact be adverse to the interests of the United States of America. Right. And I think that is the position into which we are wedged with the Electoral College.
Okay. And it seems like some modicum of agreement or form of cooperation might come up with what is that, like the referendum of the...
So it is the Interstate Electoral Vote Compact. It has its own website, and it shows which states have passed that law, which states are considering it and might pass it in the future. I think it's up to a little over 200 electoral votes at the moment, but it's got to get to 270 or more before those laws then are triggered and go into effect in the states that have passed them.
Got it. I'll have to look that up. That is fascinating. That's awesome. Very interesting stuff. Okay. Actually, Kate, I did have a question about like what would you say, Doug, about someone's vote not mattering? And I think you really actually quite covered that very eloquently in your explanation that Kate had, right? Like, I mean, that to the question that Kate asked. And I also had a question about why the Electoral College is so embattled, right? Like, because we've been talking about this for a while. We've been talking about this for a very long time. And I think that really points it out, is at its heart, whether or not it's the will of all the people, you do have the power given to the smaller, less populous states in the beginning. They got that, and you're going to need their consent to get that away from them. And the likelihood that they agree to that is probably not there. So I get that.
Yeah, absolutely. When in doubt, you can depend on the people who are in positions, I think, within any functioning democracy to probably err toward a short-term view of very own sort of self-interested motives, rather than looking at the broad spectrum of the country's interest, rather than looking at the big sweep of time. That's unfortunately often human nature, and it's the way people think about these kinds of things. But I find in the generation that is currently in college classrooms a great skepticism of the Electoral College. It is a skepticism that over time in my life as a writer and as a teacher, I have come to share. I did not, when I was, say, 20 or 25, have the level of skepticism of the Electoral College that I have come to have today. But that goes to a point that Kate raised, which is, if you hadn't had a misfire since 1888 and it didn't happen again until 2000, well, people were not thinking of the difference between the popular vote outcome and the actual election outcome in the Electoral College very frequently during that period of time.
So I do have a thought. I don't know if this affects it, but currently, especially with COVID, we've heard so many people moving out of urban areas, whether it's cost of living or they're now remote and they have that ability. I've heard, so I'm in California, so I can say I have heard numerous people, even, go into Texas, Idaho, Bozeman, I heard is blowing up in population, people moving to Montana, Wyoming, like all these different places that we're talking about that, I mean, I don't know how big Idaho is, but I think it's gotten a lot bigger from what I've heard. I wonder how over time, like this is, I feel like I don't know, maybe there's ones in the past as well, but I feel the last 2 or 3 years has been a line of demarcation in some cases of the amount of shift in populations to other places, potentially even more rural places. And I wonder how that, or if that going forward continues, happens again, as people are moving around and becoming, with the internet and everything else, more remote and the ability to kind of shift more often. Because I feel like this is a trend now happening, not really the end of a trend. I think it's starting. How that's going to influence the electoral college and, populist, but all these different things we're talking about, even if we do a workaround, you know, like I don't know if they're what the question is in there, but it came up when you started talking about the less populated areas, and those may not be less populated as they were historically going forward, potentially.
So you've raised, I think, some really important stuff there, and it would be valuable for us to explore that content here for a couple minutes. It is the case that the big picture with regard to mobility of Americans is that Americans are less geographically mobile now than they were 50, 60, and 70 years ago. Our geographic mobility has declined, which is a fact that shocks most people when they hear it. But it's very evident in the census data. People are less likely to pick up and move across state lines now than they were, say, when I was just a little kid about a half a century ago. Now, there may be all kinds of reasons for that. It may be that we have such a poor social safety net in this country that people feel they can't take the risks of moving. We know that a very significant portion of households are no more than $500 away from utter disaster, because if the refrigerator breaks or the car falls apart and they have to fix it, they're out of cash, right? So there are a whole bunch of reasons why we may have less mobility now than we did 50, 60, or 70 years ago. But you're quite right also that the pandemic has made people look at fundamental questions. How do I want to live? Where do I want to live? What kind of natural environment do I want around me? Do I want to be closer or farther from my family? And 100 other things. And we're not going to go back to the arrangement pre-pandemic by which the expectation default is that every one of us commutes every single day, 5 days a week, 50 weeks a year, into an office to be with other people who have also commuted. That's just not going to happen. And so you are seeing now, and particularly I think in the case of places that have become very populous and have the complications that come with a robust population center or set of robust population centers, California would be an example, we do now see people dispersing and trying to figure out, where is the cost of living less? Where could I get a little bit of land? And a bunch of other considerations. Now, the question is, when 10,000 people arrive in Bozeman, Montana, for example, and the housing market's prices then go crazy, does that have a self-limiting effect? In other words, housing becomes so expensive that people can't really keep moving into Bozeman right now, right? Mm-hmm. Or 50 other cities and towns like it in Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, maybe Eastern Oregon, Eastern Washington State, and other places like that. We're going to find out the answer to those kinds of things in the coming years. But to undo the mathematical effects of the Electoral College, we'd have to have huge population migrations across state borders for an extended period of time. It would have to shake up the politics of some of those states so that reliably red states start to become blue, or reliably blue states start to become red. I think we should also mention here that if you go back to the 1920s and you looked at New England was a rock-ribbed Republican bastion, right? And if you looked at the South, right, you would look at the South and you would say, wow, it was a reliably Democratic bastion. Now, those two things are opposite today. New England is progressive. The South is regressive, right? The South is a cache of electoral votes for the Republican Party. New England, by and large, is a cache of electoral votes for the Democratic Party. So over the span of a human lifetime or even longer, these things can and do change. But the change can be agonizingly slow, and at a period in time at which the country is stretched, its institutions are fraying, it has a lot of social tension. Do we have decades to wait for those things to maybe carry the day, maybe have profound effects? Well, none of us can know that. But those effects will work their way at their own pace, in their own way, at their own time, and then we'll be left to interpret them, I think, and their effects at some point.
So essentially, we don't may know. Not have the time. Like we may, like that may happen in the future, a future that if something else doesn't happen, we're not getting to that future. We're not getting to that point.
I think, unfortunately, Ben, that's right. I believe that countries are mortal things. There has never been a country that was not born and existed and later died. That's what they do. The framers speculated at various times that, you know, maybe this new republic they had created would be an 80-year thing. You know, if you could get 80 years or 100 out of it, that'd be a good run. That would be really great. Sometimes they speculated beyond a century or closer to two. But the United States, no matter how you slice it, would appear to be getting a bit long in the tooth these days. And its viability cannot be taken for granted. That is something I think that has changed since my, you know, late 20th century Midwestern upbringing. The idea that democracy is a given, that the existence of the United States of America is a given, that these things will always be solid and stable. I think we can take none of that for granted any longer. These are contested propositions now.
So in essence, we've returned to a period where we are painfully aware that this is an experiment. When we started, everyone was painfully aware that this is an experiment. And if it doesn't work out, well, it's going to be the rope for all of us, right? We're not going to make it. And again, you know, now we've kind of gone up, we've shown, you know, we're a superpower. It's great. We got a trophy case full of medals and ribbons and stuff in the back. And now we're back to not necessarily square one, but we're not as
healthy.
Well, you know, yeah. We're fragile. You know, it's an idea. America at its core is an idea. And that it should be taken care of like that. I could see that. I could see that argument. I want to
elaborate on that for just a minute, if I may. I think you're sure. Absolutely right. You know, the famous quotation of Ben Franklin was that we must hang together or we will assuredly all hang separately, right? And that spirit of the American experiment, of being in it to make the machinery work and to make it more perfect and to make the republic better over time, that has sort of been the American stock in trade. That has been the fundamental American conviction. But I think we also have to remember that however ingenious the framers were, and they were, objectively speaking, an exceptional group of learned and capable people, they developed something that fit the times in which they lived, or even to some degree superseded those times.
Right, right. I can get that.
That does not mean that their constitutional machinery is either perfect or immortal or destined to live always. It just means that they did a darn good job given what they had. And we probably do them a disservice by assuming that they would be overly cautious about reforming their own system. In fact, I think much of the writing of the Prime Framers indicates that they wished for a refreshing of their system based on the knowledge and the debates and the sensibilities and the improvements of the American populace over time. And today, I think there is a crying need for reform of many kinds. I'll just add one more thing, and that is that if you compare public policy made in the United States to that made by European democracies, they do most things way better than we do them. Whether that is public health care and the provision of vaccines to kids, never mind COVID vaccines, but just your standard battery of childhood vaccinations, whether that's water quality or environmental policy or transportation or the transition to green energy. It's not like we do most of these things as well as or better than European democracies. We simply do not. And at some point, if the system in which you live is really not that good at making excellent public policy, then you have to ask, well, why is that so? And can anything be done to improve what the system is giving us?
I could see that point. On the last thing that you said, can anything be done to improve on what the system is giving us? Let's talk about voting, but less on a higher level and more, let's bring it down a bit to voting behaviors. One question I really have is, I mean, surely we have enough technology and influence today versus in the past, especially versus at our creation. You know, if only there was a Twitter or a Facebook or a Instagram to connect people in such a way. But I think there may be arguably a waning of back then. It was very much, I guess, civic duty is a term that comes to mind, right? Like, I'm a citizen of the America. What does that mean? It means at its core, when asked the questions of my state, what my opinion is, I give it. And more so, in modern times, you have a lot more people that are like, why do I vote? It's kind of an inconvenience to me. I got to go over there and do the thing. And it doesn't really matter, right? Like what I say, no one cares. So why should I even contribute? What do you see? What are you seeing in your research with voting behaviors? Voting, I mean, I know that we can actually get back up. You mentioned it before, some states are taking wide latitude with the Voting Act to enact certain legislation to impact the voting population. What are you seeing voting-wise? Participation, behaviors, or attitudes toward citizenship? We have progressed, we progressed from citizenship, like America, is that idea is precious and it's fragile and you should always keep it forward in your mind. And you have a duty, civic duty, I guess I'm going to stick with civic duty is your responsibility as a citizen of this great nation. And we've kind of evolved to from citizenship that it's more a birthright, and that it is, but like in a birthright, like you can, I don't even need to hold on to it because there's no way that you can pry it from my fingers, right? Like I just take it for granted. It's me. I can't change it. I do what I want. What are you seeing voting behavior wise?
Yeah, so I think it's important to note that we romanticize voting in many ways as one aspect of American history. But in the 20th century, for example, Americans really didn't turn out to vote at extremely high percentages. In the modern period, say from the 1920s forward, the high watermark for voter participation, and I'll say more about this in a minute, until at least the most recent elections, was 1960, John F. Kennedy, the Democratic nominee versus the Republican nominee, Richard Nixon, 60%. approximately 60% of people voted, which was kind of a high watermark. And then that receded for a period of decades. And then it ticked up on occasion, but only really by the time you get to 2008, 2012, 2016, 2020, are voting rates in presidential elections in this country higher than that previous benchmark of 60%. Now, by comparison, in European democracies or New Zealand or Australia or other parts of the Western community of democratic countries, rates of voting in those countries are 90 or 95.
I didn't expect that. Okay.
So we, if you'll pardon my language, we suck at voting. We don't take it seriously. We don't bother. We are bothering more recently because there's a sense that there's a lot on the line, that things matter. And we are in two-party coalitions that are very polarized, that disagree on a lot of things. And so there's a heightened sense that it matters to get out and vote. And it does. And it's that point that I want to zoom in on for a minute. Part of this notion of American exceptionalism that has kind of permeated the American experiment from the very beginning has been the idea that, well, you know, things happen to other countries and they happen in other countries, but they don't happen here in this country and they don't happen to America. Okay. Which, of course, would I think be the very definition of arrogance, right? That what happens to other mortal countries can't and doesn't happen to the United States of America. Well, all things that happen to countries can happen to the United States. And I think in their various ways and at their various levels, Americans lately have realized, like, wow, if you have an event like January 6th, that's about as potentially serious and fatal to a republic as it gets. And so maybe I better pay attention. Maybe I better put in a little bit of work to go out and vote. And yet, even in a presidential election like 2020, in which nearly 160 million Americans or so voted and turnout was pretty high, it's not healthy or robust turnout by the standards of other functioning democracies. That is in large measure because we have this patchwork of different laws and regulations and approaches and ways of doing our voting all across the states of the United States. On some level, that's irrational. That doesn't make a heck of a lot of sense, but it is one of the obstacles to making sure that Americans who want to vote do in fact get an opportunity to go to the polls to cast their vote and to have their votes counted in the outcome.
Wow. Wow. There's a lot there, right? Kate, Danny, you want to jump in there? No?
No, I'm still processing.
I mean, and there's a lot to process, right? Like that, first of all, going back to just comparable democracies, America, there's a lot to, I am also still processing that. So point one that I think you just covered, you know, other democracies are in the 90th about, right? Percentile. And even if I say, even if I'm like, Doug, it's absolutely wrong. It's like 80, right? Okay, so 80 is still 20 higher than 60. And that was the best, you know? So it's like understood, right? Like they are far more efficient in that. And that I definitely think the takeaway for me is there's something to be learned there, right? Like, you know, whoever you want to emulate, pick one. It seems like they all got something that's working for them.
Absolutely.
So that actually brings me to my, now I have a question because I processed. So what do you see are the trends or the reasons for that behavior, even in the very like beginning, let's say in 1920, like that wasn't that long after the compared. What do you see as the trends or what do you see as the reasons for that level of or non-level of participation as in voting?
Yeah, there are several or even many reasons why voter turnout as a percentage of eligible voters in this country has not been as robust as probably it could be and as we may even think that it should be. One of those reasons is that we have many elections, not only every 2 years at the federal level do we have an election, but we have state and local elections as well. And so we have this system of federalism where pretty much every year you're going to have a chance to vote on something. It may be a very local office. It may be a county executive. It may be statewide races that are synced to the off year of federal elections, right? That's a lot for voters, for citizens to keep track of. So there's that. That makes things pretty complicated. But then I think we also have to ask, if you did take the trouble to go out and vote in 2016, and let's just say that the hypothetical voter in this case voted for Hillary Clinton for president of the United States, and she got 3 more million votes than the other candidate, but then did not take office as president of the United States, well, what is the lesson there from taking the trouble to participate? Well, it may not be a very encouraging one. It may be that, well, that Electoral College thing does whatever the hell it does, regardless of the balance of the popular vote. Now, having just said that, I want to use 2016 as an example in another way. We had diminished voter turnout in some of the big cities in Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania. And a total of about 70-some thousand votes spread across 3 states meant that Donald Trump was able to win by a whisker the popular vote in those states, get the Electoral College votes of those states, and become president of the United States. So one way to look at that fairly, I think, is to ask, would it have been in the interest of a bunch of people who kind of stayed home in those cities and were like, well, I liked Barack Obama a lot, but I'm not as crazy about Hillary Clinton, but Donald Trump could never win anyway. Would it have paid for them to take the trouble to go and vote? Well, I think in retrospect, they would say, you know, maybe that would have been worth an hour of my time. Mm. But that really points out the fact that it always matters in democracies that we participate, because they are delicate things. They take care and watering. They take constant participation. And if we think we can be a citizen of a democracy, but not exercise our duties, including voting, we probably are going to end up being disillusioned. We're probably going to find a democracy in decay and one that will perish sooner than if we cared enough to put ourselves in the game and participate more.
Okay. And to piggyback on that, right, like that disillusionment when there is participation, whether reluctant or enthusiastic or whatever, and that's the result for the populist vote, and you're disillusioned. I think what also contributes to the disillusionment is such a significant absence of the populace not partaking allows an opportunity for speculation. Like if that 40% had voted the way that Ben would have voted, then obviously, I mean, which is a pretty, it's easy to do, because that 40%, there's no way to go back and say they would have voted this way or this way. There's no trend. And just like, why would I vote and do my thing if nearly half the country doesn't? But with I'm seeing with your input on those 90, the democracies with the 90, no matter what your system is, electoral or otherwise, if you have 90% of the votes counted, and it's like, let's just call it a populist vote. And it's one way. I mean, yeah, I said I'd pick the other guy, but I mean, we all said something, right? Like I can't point to this phantom percentage, this significant phantom percent, like 10% okay, great. But would that 10% have swayed the vote? That's a different discussion. It matters on how close the race was. But, you know, largely, no matter what the race, I could point to a 40% absence of voting to, well, this is why. That's the reason. Why is the reason? I don't know. Did my guy win? I don't know. Did my guy lose? But that absence of the 40% that didn't say anything, that's the reason for whatever I need to suit my needs, right? Right there. So it's very interesting. It's very interesting.
Absolutely. No, I think the example of 2016 and those three states in the upper Midwest, right? The very razor thin margin. You know, what does that margin consist of? It consists of a lot of individual voters making their determination. Well, can I be bothered to vote or not? Is it worth my time to vote or not? Well, maybe your one vote will not be the one vote that determines an outcome in your state. But collectively, if there are 13 or 15 or 50 or 70,000 people who decide at the last minute, you know, I'm not going to vote. Well, then that does absolutely determine the outcome in many instances. So individual votes always matter. There's one other topic on this that we really haven't talked about, and it is something that discourages people from voting, and that is that we have a two-party system in this country, not a system of several political parties. We have a two-party system because the Constitution gave us winner-take-all elections in geographic districts, right? That might be a House district, it might be a state in the case of the Senate. But if you finish second in an election in any state or district in this country, you get nothing, right? You lose. That has limited us to two political parties. So, you know, we don't have a Green Party. We don't have a truly progressive party. We don't have the Republican Party split into, say, a, you know, wing that is a Freedom Caucus Tea Party wing and the other that is an establishment wing. And I do think that if there were, say, a different infrastructure, which again, we're back to the question of constitutional amendments and, you know, the fact that we're not a parliamentary democracy, we're a presidential democracy. But I do think if there were well-articulated additional political parties in this country, say a Green Party, that would be a source of great motivation and great enthusiasm for a significant number of people in this country to vote. That would be a big deal. But we don't have that. We're probably not going to have any of that anytime soon. So that is also something, a structural reason why people may shy away from voting. They only have two teams to pick from instead of four or five, for example.
Huh. Is there any way that we can, you think that could be mitigated? Not having more, you know, not having more political parties. It's not allowed for in our actual system, right? And according to Kate and I's conversation, we actually looked at the existence of political parties as, in fact, a very strong trend and not a system, right? Like it's not, they have systems, the parties themselves, but it's all very nebulous. Is there anything that you think that we could do to mitigate that, either influence-wise or anything?
There is a United States law on the books from the late 1960s that says that states cannot have proportional representation elections for the House, for the United States House. A number of them had expressed interest and had moved in that way. There's no constitutional reason that you could not have a statewide vote for the House and then allot your House seats on the basis of party to correspond in rounded numbers to a statewide popular vote. But the House and Senate of the United States ruled that out with a law in the late 1960s. That was a bad choice. On the state level, what could be done? States should move toward a proportional representation. We should not have to tie representation to land and to specific districts and states. We should think about having proportional elections in this country on the state level. We should crack down on gerrymandering, both on the state level and better yet, with a national law upheld by a very different Supreme Court in the future. These are all
gerrymandering. Would you just give us a brief what gerrymandering is.
Gerrymandering is the practice by a party that controls the legislative bodies in a state of when they get a chance to draw district lines, not only for the state house and the state senate, but also for the United States House, to draw them in a way that penalizes one party and benefits another party. So that in many districts now, for the United States House, for example, there is no chance that there can be a competitive election in that district. It will always be won by the Republican candidate, or it will always be won by the Democratic candidate, which means that the people living in that district literally don't have a voice and they don't have a choice. They are doomed to have one party or the other emerge victorious from that district all the time. That's a really bad practice, I think, that is fundamentally undemocratic. It strikes at the heart of the notion that candidates should have to discuss issues. They should have to have stands on policies. They should have to have a clash of ideas that could, at least in theory, persuade people to vote one way or the other for one candidate or the other to represent that district. But we are so far from that. In many United States House districts, we are so far from that. For example, here in Ohio, we have a very big supermajority in the state legislature in both the House and the Senate of the Republican Party at the moment. And the gerrymandering has been so efficient and so effective that the Republican Party has sort of barricaded itself into power for the foreseeable future. It's going to take many years for there to be truly competitive elections for the state house and the state senate, and even the United States House in Ohio, for example, which is a weird way for a country that is so boastful about being a democratic country, about being quote unquote a great democracy or the greatest democracy. It's a very weird way for the United States to end up at this time.
Okay.
I can speak for myself. Being in California, growing up in California, you kind of knew where your votes were, like whether or not you voted, you knew how it was going to go, you know, because of the population. So it kind of goes back to, especially for president, right? So it kind of goes back to the conversation that we had around the smaller populous states versus larger populous states. And I wonder if the benefit of being a smaller populous state is you have the ability to influence more with your vote compared to higher populous states, and how things, maybe that's not the case because of what you're talking about just now, but it just makes me think of that because, you know, whether you're Republican or Democrat in California, you know, you're either happy or you're not based on how things go, but there's not much changing how things go because, you know, it's such a large state. So I don't know, it just, again, brought up something for me inside of that, wondering, and I get the burnout. Like, I think what you're talking about earlier is the voter burnout of how many votes we have to elections there are and all of the stuff around that. Like, you know, I get what you're saying.
I think in the example of California, obviously, at the present time, the 50 plus House seats are overwhelmingly dominated by Democrats. That is, yes, the result of gerrymandering on the margins for some of those districts. It's also the result of a bigger political change. If you go back to, say, the 1980s, right? Yeah. Orange County and many parts of California were pretty much bastions of the Reagan Revolution. They were, you know, very much in keeping with the tenor of the times in terms of California having a robust conservative movement and a big part of the populace that was quite conservative. California obviously has changed over the decades, and it is very different now than it used to be. But I want to point out my home state of Iowa as one of the examples of a state that in the early 1970s decided it would not allow politicians to draw the boundaries of United States House districts. It instead created a civil service commission. Now, Iowa only has four United States House seats, But in any given election, three of those are very, very close and very competitive. They can swing back and forth between the two parties over time. There's only really one of those four districts in the northwest part of the state that is always going to elect one party. In this case, it happens to be a very conservative area of the state, and it always elects a Republican. But the boundaries are drawn well enough across all four districts that three of them could fluctuate either way. Now, that is a conscious choice that Iowa made in the early 1970s to draw its districts that way. More states are beginning to move toward that kind of model. And if they would do it, I think that would give people a sense that, you know, if I pay attention and I show up and I vote, the outcome this year could be different than it was 2 years ago or different than it was 4 years ago. So I better pay attention and show up to vote.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And for our listeners out there, I just want to say that I know I'm not the first to say this, but I think we should have Citizenship Day, and it should fall on. So it's a national federal holiday. Everybody takes off from work. It's every year. So if you have an election that year, great. And if you don't have an election that year, enjoy your day off. Have fun, maybe read something civic-minded, right? Like brush up on your electoral college or American Constitution and whatever. But we should put it on so when the federal election, what is it, first Tuesday in November, right? Like, that's, there you go. It's like Thanksgiving, it moves. We put it on a day, you get it off. Tell your worker, your company, I'm not sick, I'm not taking a day. I'm a citizen of the U.S. This is Citizenship Day. We're good. So
yeah. So let's talk about that for a minute, Ben, because I think it's really important. After the very close squeaker of a presidential election in 2000, new President George W. Bush appointed a commission to study elections in the United States, and it came back with a bipartisan recommendation. We need to have a national holiday for Election Day. We need the country to close down so that no one needs to go to work. There's only one thing you really can do that day. You can go vote. That is the way that other Western democracies do it. If we wanted or valued or thought it was important for people in this country to vote, we would not be requiring them to worry about on Election Day, work shift one and work shift two, and how early do things open and how late do they stay open before they are closed? And what about childcare? And what about commuting? And what about 100 other things? We would make it a national priority to have a national voting holiday. It's a normal thing that democracies do, but we can't even seem to get ourselves together enough to do just that.
I actually knew none of that until you just said it. I feel strangely like validated right now. But
I feel like I've heard in the last 6 months or a year, there's a proposal or something out there to again bring that up as a national holiday. I thought I heard that. I don't know if it went anywhere.
I know a lot of things, but I thought I made that up. But I figured it wasn't. I couldn't be the first person to think about it. But I feel strangely validated, but yet a little sad that it's not going to be Citizenship Day. I'm pretty sure I came up with that just now on my own. But oh well, can't win them all.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Bratabo, for your expertise. I think this was a great conversation inside of voter context, voter system behavior, etc. So thank you for your time and being here.
Thank you. This was a real pleasure. It's not every day that I get to catch up with a student I haven't seen in a couple decades there, Ben. So this was very fun to spend this time with both of you. I enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you for joining us, Doug. I appreciate it. It's great to see you once more. And that's it for our episode for today, listeners. Until then, next time, keep discussing.
Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe, follow us on social media, and check out our Patreon page. Leave us a review on your listening platform if you like the podcast. If you haven't heard your viewpoint or would like to be a guest, email us at info@artofdiscussing.com.
Till next time, remember there's more sides to the story than yours. Look, listen and learn, and keep discussing.